Everyone knows some version of this story. A millionaire enjoying life immensely tells his minister that despite his good luck and his big contributions to the church, he is still worried about whether he will make it to heaven. Since you're supposed to have an inside track on these things, he tells the minister, would you consider asking for some signal as to where I'm going to end up? The minister says yes, he'll try. A few days later, he phones and says, well, I have some good news and some bad news. The good news is that you're going to go to heaven. Wonderful. But what's the bad news? The bad news is, can you be ready by Thursday? Apparently, we haven't yet been able to imagine a heaven so tempting that we're positively eager to leave this life to get there. What I gather from a lifetime of hearing people talk about heaven is that they hope it will be very nice when they finally have to go, but they don't want to rush it. One could be excused for wondering how much the people who talk a lot about heaven really believe in it. But one thing is certain. It would be hard to find any major culture in which people have not dreamed of a life after this life where everything would be far better than it is here. It doesn't take much thought to understand why. We long for perfection, and it always eludes us. Our crops fail. We are slowed by illness. The flesh grows weary and tired no matter how hard we fight to keep it young. And all around us, people we love go away from us. So all over the world, people have imagined what it would be like to go somewhere else after death where everything would be exactly the way they'd like it to be forever and ever. And invariably, they have pictured this afterlife as an extension of the good things they had on earth, or wished they had. The Eskimo who had to fight bitter cold so much of his life dreamed of a heaven that would be located in the warm earth. Desert people, short of food and water, imagined the afterlife as a kind of green oasis. Palm trees, loaded with mouth-watering dates above pools of crystal water. The Muslim warrior was promised not only those good things if he died fighting the enemy, but also 72 beautiful women to serve him forever. A kind of Hugh Hefner heaven that may have been the most successful incentive for fighting men in the history of war. The American Indian dreamed of a happy hunting ground where great herds of buffalo rumbled across endless prairies and a great spirit smiled with favor upon braves who rode their pinto ponies like the wind and whose sharp arrows never missed. Scandinavian people, whose lives had so much to do with fighting, promised their dying heroes that women called Valkyries would sweep down on mighty horses to gather them up and carry them off to Valhalla, a Norse paradise, a place where they could hack away at each other all day long in glorious battle, come home at night to drink fermented honey and eat roast beef and be miraculously healed so that they could wake up the next day and start all over again. permanent war with no fatalities. That was heaven. When you read this kind of folklore, you ask yourself whether the men who wrote about heaven in the Bible may have been operating on the same principle, drawing from their own culture and experience to describe an afterlife that would be appealing. If they did that, some of the furniture of their heaven would be likely to seem peculiar to us, perhaps not very appealing at all. And this is exactly what happens. I saw a cartoon in the New Yorker that makes the point. Three or four older men, each with a halo and a set of stubby wings, are tugging small harps dutifully tucked under their arms. Obviously not very happy. They're looking across at some buddies on the next cloud who also have the halos and the wings, but have exchanged the harps for something more in line with the world they left behind. They are headed for the links with golf clubs tucked under their arms, a heaven quite a few of my friends in this church, at whom I am looking at this moment, would enjoy. In other words, most of us, if we could create our own heaven, would do it very differently from the way the author does it in the book of Revelation. I asked some adult students to tell me one time what they would like. I had a marvelous variety of answers. Some of the men wanted the Super Bowl or the Final Four every week. A couple of the wives said they'd prefer a place where they'd never have those things. One person even wanted a library with all those books that were burned in Alexandria such a long time ago. They asked for my choices. I said an ocean to walk by on one side and a big freshwater lake on the other filled with hungry bass. The point is that not a single one of us picked harps or gates of pearl or streets of gold. So where did those things come from? Well, they came straight out of ancient Hebrew culture, which means we have to translate that poetry into our own without being too literal-minded. For example, it was hard in biblical times to make a living in Palestine. Food, almost always scarce. So a prominent feature of their heaven is a remarkable tree that grows 12 different kinds of fruit each month. It's easy enough to understand why people without a supermarket would imagine a miraculous orchard for their heaven. But why 12 crops? And why 12 months? In a world where concern with numbers and even with time itself would seem illogical. Why are there 12 gates and 12 foundations and 12,000 furlongs around the city? And walls 144 cubits high, which is 12 squared. The answer is cultural conditioning. In their history, 12 was a holy number. Even the nation was made up of 12 tribes. So heaven had to correspond. I'd just as soon have 10 gates and 4 foundations, but it's their picture of the ideal afterlife, not mine, And they wrote it to make sense for their own people. When you and I want water, we walk to a tap and turn it. We have so much that we water lawns, and we hose down driveways, and we cool off the sides of houses on hot summer evenings. We take it so much for granted that it might not occur to us to create a municipal waterworks in heaven. But in Palestine, a well was priceless, and a spring was a gift from God Himself. So no wonder that when a Jewish writer sketched heaven, he saw a river of the water of life, sparkling like crystal, flowing from the throne of God. And no wonder he promised his readers in a burst of joy that God Himself would guide them to the springs of the water of life. Did he really mean all those things to be taken literally? Probably not. But to make symbols that would have meaning for his people, he drew pictures from the life they knew. 2,000 years later, it might not seem relevant, but that was not his concern. The Jewish people lived near the Mediterranean Sea, but they had some ancient stories that linked the ocean with the dark forces of chaos, and they never seemed very comfortable with it. So it's no great surprise that when Jewish history shapes the landscape of heaven in our book of Revelation, the ocean is missing. There is a sun and a moon and a river, trees, food, clothing, all those familiar things from earth, but no ocean. They even take pains to point it out. There shall be no more ocean. The sea shall be no more. From their point of view, it's understandable. From my point of view, it's disappointing. Palestine is a hot country. Temperatures in the Jordan Valley can go as high as 130 degrees. Heat stroke was an ever-present danger. So no wonder that Jewish writers spoke longingly of the shadow of a mighty rock, that sudden cool shade in the desert that might save your life. And no wonder when heaven was furnished, it was a place where the sun shall not light on them, nor any heat. That particular blessing would probably not occur to me. This Judeo-Christian heaven was imagined as an enormous cube, 500 miles on every side. But why a cube? Why not a geodesic dome or a simple rectangular space? The answer is that in ancient Jewish history, the most holy place in the tabernacle was a perfect cube. So heaven is made to correspond with it. Through most of their history, the writers of the Bible were poor and tremendously impressed by great wealth. So heaven becomes an incredible concentration of precious stones and metals. The wall is built of jasper. The foundation is inlaid with sapphire, onyx, emerald, topaz, amethyst, 12 different precious stones in all, corresponding to the 12 stones that had adorned the breastplate of the high priest in the mourning time of Hebrew history. Why should heaven be a walled city at all. It's a place no one can attack. It is, by implication, a place no one would want to leave. It's not a question, however, that would have entered the mind of the man who wrote about it. His audience was used to cities with walls, so heaven has walls. Most of you grew up in more sophisticated religions than I did, so you may not be able to relate to what I am about to say next. We sang some amazing songs about heaven. I threatened on the way out here this morning to sing these, but I haven't the courage. We will rest in the fair and happy land by and by, just across on the evergreen shore. It was Canaan's fair and happy land. We warbled without even noticing that Canaan had never been our land and that we had very little notion of what Canaan had been like. We dropped the cube business, which meant nothing to us, and the high wall and the names of the 12 tribes on the 12 gates, because all those things were foreign to our lives. But we found some things to which we could open our hearts. Gold we knew about and longed for. So we sang 1,000 times in my childhood, "The streets, I am told, are paved with pure gold." Even in the Great Depression, we had plenty of water from the city lake. So it meant nothing to us to read in Scripture about spring water and huge pearls and a giant throne. But times were tough and life was hard, and nothing sounded better to us than all that gold and the promise that God would wipe away all tears from our eyes and that death and separation would vanish forever. We remade the images. We sang about the tree of life, all right, in eternal bloom, and how it sheds its fragrance through the unclouded day, which was a nice little touch we added to the Bible. And we sang about a summer land of bliss, beyond this land of toiling, losing, and leaving. Alliteration always helped. All the things we didn't have and wished we had, except that it made us sad to think we had to die in order to get them, so that our songs of ultimate bliss were always curiously mournful. Some night at a church banquet, if you create the right atmosphere, Bob Scott and I and Wayne Linder, the two of them to overcome the effects of the third, might be willing to sing some of those old songs for you, knowing that even as we sing them, the words and the melodies will be entwined with the memories of some of the people we have loved most. I feel very differently about some of these things than I did when I was a child. I've listened carefully for a long time to all the pros and cons of life beyond the grave, and my definition of eternal life tends now to be qualitative rather than quantitative, measured in intensity rather than in years. But I would treat tenderly the faith of millions whose dreams are innocent and good. No lovelier idea has ever captured the human heart than this hope of final union with God in a land where tears are only a memory. But when the moment comes for bowing out, I hope I can feel that the adventure has been so exciting that if it should turn out that nothing happens later, I shall not feel cheated. Not unless, with beauty all around me, I had no eyes for it, or with people along the way to love, I had refused to love. In which case, I would already have missed heaven, and I would not expect the loss to be made up.